On this week's Bet the Process podcast, Rufus and I have a very special guest. We have Kurt Goldsberry, who is our first ever geography major guest, but also an amazing data visualization analytics person who's been in the MBA. He's been doing it for like 15 years. So he's been there, he's done that, and he has some really great insights about the current game and also about just data visualization as a tool. Rufus and I talk a little bit about the draft and recap a little bit of the Cade Massey episode, which if you haven't listened last week, you should really go back and listen. And so with that, let's start the process.
Bet the process. Bet the process. Welcome to the podcast, Bet the Process. It's not the typical cookie cutter nonsense. If you came just for picks, you're in the wrong place. Find a tout with the narrative to make a strong case. Instead of blindly assuming a team must be tanking, we're looking for the edge of Massey Peabody rankings. Crunching all the numbers in a simulated system that break down the data, analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic.
Welcome to another episode of the Bet the Process podcast. Rufus and I are, Rufus in New York. I'm in the greater Bay Area, and I'm going to actually be in New York next week. So we were discussing all the things that we would do in New York. Any good restaurants you've been to recently in New York, Rufus?
Yeah, I went to this place yesterday called Bar Bar, B-A-A-R, B-A-A-R. It's actually close by me. It's like Indian, but upscale, fusion-y. It's quite good. By the way, Jeff, I'm watching as we podcast. I'm watching my podcast studio being constructed.
You're going to become professional. Does that mean you're going to learn how to articulate a point without it rambling on for 25 minutes?
Probably not. A little more complicated than a podcast studio construction.
Are they installing that for you?
In my brain?
Hopefully.
We'll see.
What did you think of the draft? And I there is a good macro topic we can talk about, which is the Kanzi criticism of the Cade Massey podcast.
Yeah.
What did you think of?
So I followed the beginning of the draft. I actually watched draft coverage probably for the first time in my life for like the first six picks, basically. And that was it. But I mean, I think that we all probably agree that the Penix pick just seems like a train wreck in terms of both the value perspective and how it fits into your organizational plan. You know, you draft,
yeah.
I don't have any amazing insight to add here because everybody's already said everything really, but you know, you're drafting a 24-year-old quarterback who's very injury prone and you have Kirk Cousins on the team. And so if you're going to literally have to, if he's going to have to wait 2 years, then he loses the value of the rookie deal as well.
Yeah. You know, one thing I think is interesting about this Bo Nix and Penix thing is it bad to draft an older quarterback? I know, like, generally if you were to be able to hold these guys and control them and they would be under like reasonable contracts and the back to the indentured servant model, then you definitely want young because there's more upside and whatnot. But in a situation where the cheat code is having a good quarterback on a
rookie deal,
you know, rookie deal, wouldn't you want someone that was a little further along and developed? Or am I thinking about this the wrong way?
I think that they have less room for growth, less upside. I think that's the big thing. If you were drafting who the player was right now, not who you thought they could be in 3 or 4 years, then you could make that argument. But then the ordering would look kind of different probably.
Right. But my point is that in 3 or 4 years, you're going to pay them as if like you're always wanting to like,
I get your point.
Be ahead on a contract, right? Essentially, right. You're always wanting to have like value on a contract. Like that's the kind of key in the salary cap. So wouldn't
it's
make
a very
sense?
Good point. But the question is like, is there a quarter? Are you saying that Bo Nix right now is this really good quarterback and where teams are undervaluing him because they don't think he's going to improve as much? Or like, I don't see that. I don't see him being that much higher.
I guess what I'm saying is there's this natural bias towards like age in drafts generally, right? Like in college basketball, like people always want to draft like younger players with more upside. And
yes, conditional on performance level, I think you definitely want younger just because there's more room for growth. there is more upside and you are getting to participate in that upside. And I think that the development happens pretty quickly. I think there's a lot more development at a younger age than there is once you get older. So, I mean, it's the same thing, like the argument I've made about I think you want guys that have had poor coaching because it means there's more room for growth.
Yeah. And this goes back to your golfer argument about golfers that play in cold weather climates and whatnot. I get that again, but like,
and I get what you're saying too. Like what you're saying basically, cause you're like, well, if we only care about this small chunk of time here where there's going to be surplus value, shouldn't we just go for who's best right now?
Well, I think if you go back to this concept of like, how do you win a Super Bowl, right? And ultimately, like, there's two cheat codes. There's have a quarterback on a rookie contract, or there's have Patrick Mahomes, one of the two. I mean, it's like, that's kind of, I mean, seriously, that's what it's like. Because I was having this argument with someone.
You have to have a superstar or quarterback on a rookie deal where you're, and like the Brock Purdy situation where you're getting more value elsewhere.
Well, although, yeah, I mean,
the Niners
think about,
now are going to have to, like, I mean, their problem is the rest of their players are too good, and now they're going to have to pay them.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it isn't just having a good quarterback on a rookie deal, though. It's about, like, you can make the argument for other positions as well. It's about getting surplus value. And when you have players in a cost-controlled way is on their rookie deals. Quarterback is just the position that matters the most, and it's going to be the biggest salary cap hit if you have to pay a superstar. So, or even if you have to pay just a mid-level quarterback for that matter.
It's the one that, like, well, again, I think that's a good point, right? Brought from a broader perspective, surplus value is the, you know, it's like water's wet. You want surplus value. Wherever you get it is great. Potentially, it seems like the place that you can get the most surplus value is at the highest paid position, right? Quarterback. So
the most important
that's
position.
That's why they do it. But probably the reality is that's the position that's probably the hardest to be successful at early on in your career, right? It's complicated. It's, you know, the development in college isn't there. I mean, yeah, this goes back to the offensive tackles or the offensive linemen kind of situation where there's more certainty. And certainly, like, offensive tackles, that like a left tackle still gets paid quite a bit of money, right? I mean, I haven't looked at salaries lately, but
left tackle is like
one
of
the highest paid position.
Yeah, for sure. Most
second
important on the offensive
important,
line, right?
Theoretically. Yeah.
Or it's considered by the market
second
to be.
Most, yeah. What did you think of the whole, like, Kanzi comment and what are you laughing
do
about?
Do you want to say what it is? No, I think it was kind of funny. The whole idea of Cade being overconfident in his thought that people are overconfident. I thought it was pretty hilarious.
Well, he was also just more frustrated that it was almost like people were throwing their hands up in the air and saying, like, oh, we can't figure this out, so we might as well just not figure it out. But go ahead.
I mean, do you want to, for context, like, say what the comment was?
Yeah, go for it.
I'm asking you. Do you have it in front of you?
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me, but I can get it in front of me. I mean, if I had it in front of me, I would be prepared, and we know that that's not something that is a mark of this podcast, so...
But while you get it in front of you, I will say, I think in a good analogy, the throwing your hands up in the air part is kind of, I don't think it's throwing your hands up in the air. It's saying, okay, this isn't maybe the haystack to focus on. This isn't, like, it's a lot of work for maybe a tiny bit of alpha, whereas there's better opportunities elsewhere. Like, if someone told me, like, you could bet Premier League games at close, but I could only get to bet 7 of them per year, would that be something I want to focus on? No, right? Certainly, like, it's a harder market to beat, and you don't have that many opportunities. And, like, if you do beat it, there's not, you're doing it on pretty slim margins, basically. Whereas,
so
like, in terms
said,
of positional value, yeah, okay.
He said, I was actually left quite annoyed after listening to this one. Really feels like Cade is overconfident about others' overconfidence. The vibe I'm getting is that this drafting thing is too hard, so why even try? And I don't think that definitely was not our message, right? My message was that on the margin, we know that there's just really big errors in these, you know, these evaluations. So why wouldn't you just, rather than believing that you know so much more than everyone else, why wouldn't you give yourself just more shots on goal and ultimately, like, allow that those shots on goals. And of course, you want to take those shots as calculated as possible with your model as possible. But I think the real question becomes, like, in this situation right now, if you had, let's just say that, like, Caleb Williams was by far the best. And then after that, you had, you know, Jaden, Drake, JJ, Bo, Penix, whatever. You had all of them. The question becomes, like, should you trade up to get one of them because you believe, or, but I guess it's like, you can't answer this in a vacuum because you also know, you're also trying to predict what the market's going to do. And ultimately, like, let's just say for whatever reason, you really do like Penix, like, you're not going to draft all the way up to get Penix because you know, likely no one's going to do that. And that's where I would say, like, are you really that confident that someone, you know, something that someone else said was, if you don't believe that you need to trade up because the quarterback that you want is going to fall to you, that means that your evaluation was probably bad. I forgot who said that, but someone else said that. And I was like, no.
Right, but you need to, but what if your value, but if it's directionally correct?
Well, this is just the you know, the,
My point basically is that, and I think Cade's point is that the market for player evaluation, as weird as this is going to sound, is efficient. It is, that doesn't mean it's perfect. There's so many unknowns. It is very wrong all the time, but it's as efficient as it can be in the sense that there aren't massive, I mean, that there hasn't been demonstrable predictive skill displayed by participants, right? That's what Cade's paper found. Or I don't know if it was, well, that's his initial paper. Yeah. Or that might've been something a little bit later, but where he found that in essence, there wasn't people that had good drafts relative to the positions they were picking weren't likely to have better drafts moving forward. Right. So to me, it's a market efficiency thing is, and I know that sounds weird because we know how bad it seems like we are at predicting who's going to be good and who's not.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the whole argument around what your, like, lack of understanding, how that should drive you to behave is inherently like it's so counter to human nature, because ultimately you want to be confident in anything you do. And it's hard to have the humility to admit, like, that I might not know something, and therefore the best thing to do is, like, defer a bit, not necessarily just to the market, but just defer to, like, this idea of giving myself as many shots on goal as possible.
And I mean, I get that there's a lot that's hard to measure. I mean, the fact that the difference between a number one and number two this year, at least according to popular consensus, is really high because there is one player that kind of stands out. In some drafts, that's not the case. So I think Cade is right that we kind of have to be pretty humble because there's a lot we don't know. But it's like, if it's kind of like if I say that, like, okay, the average running back is only worth, you know, starting running back is only worth like a tenth of a point over their backup, like, it's going to be hard for me to believe that there's a running back that's worth 3 points, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, if it's really hard for us to find demonstrable skill relative to the market here, then there probably is some, but it's probably all not that large in magnitude. Otherwise, we would have found more of it.
Okay, makes sense.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have just been, because we are not able to measure it perfectly. We don't have a perfect data set, et cetera.
Anything else pop out to you about the draft? Were you happy with what the Redskins did as the Commanders?
Well, I mean,
what's wrong with me?
I think so. I don't know. I'm not an evaluator. Did they trade up? Or, I mean, I don't believe they traded up, did they?
As long as they didn't trade up, you're happy.
Basically.
But that, again, then that goes back to this idea that, like, you are process focused and you just want them to have a good process. And, like, ultimately you think if they didn't trade up, they didn't make any glaring mistakes likely. And so, like, you're in that bias of, like, the don't fuck up bias versus
exactly,
like, aggressively going after something.
Actually, one other thing we could discuss is the idea of what the proper discount rate should be for future year picks versus now year picks.
Yeah, because I saw that thing that Seth Walder said where he's like, there should be no discount value, right? And you kind of responded, you didn't know shit about analytics, you ESPN analytics person.
You didn't well, really I was say having that, interest. But... I was having an interesting discussion with actually someone that works on the baseball side with the Mariners. Kind of, I'm not going to say his name because I don't know without permission. But
I mean, you literally can probably guess it at this point, right?
Well, he's a.
I think
he's
this
a,
guy reached out to me on Twitter once.
He's a Yaley.
What's that?
Yeah.
Oh.
No, but I mean, he had some interesting points, and he kind of basically proposed that ideally, the in essence, the discount rate should be related to the probability of a GM being fired, right? So if 5% of GMs are fired, they should be discounting the future roughly 5%.
But wait, that's a discount rate to the GM themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
That's not the right. If you're thinking about from a macro perspective, that's not the right discount rate.
Correct.
Right?
It depends on what we're trying to measure. Right. Do we want the discount?
Okay, let's assume that you're a fan and all that you care about is your team wins a championship. I think the point would be that there should be no discount rate. I think Seth Walder's point may be reasonable there because there should be no discount rate.
False.
Unless you're saying that like the discount rate is based on the certainty of life.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the minimum. You should like, what's the probability of my death in the next year, or my not being able to enjoy this to the same amount, ending.
Or a global pandemic that actually shuts down sports?
Exactly. But also, I would argue that your utility from being a fan of sports teams decreases as you get older. Would you agree?
Yeah, but like so
you're
much of this discount rate
you're
stuff that you're talking, yeah, for sure. So much of this discount rate stuff that you're talking about is very personally motivated. I think the question becomes like, what should the real discount rate be for draft picks where an organization is focused on winning a championship, period?
I agree. I think there's two different things, right? There's what it should be based on the incentives that people actually have, and then what it actually should be ideally if there was no principal agent problem, or as I call it, the principal Asian problem. I mean, that's the problem with this podcast, but I think that, what my friend Mariner's friend proposes is the funny thing is what like GMs should do if they were acting kind of rationally in a way. But what we see with the trades, I think what Massey and Thaler showed based on draft day trades is that like the interest rate is essentially like close to 100%, the discount rate, right? Which seems just insane. It seems like such a huge inefficiency that even if your job is on the line,
Right. So that's again, that's classic principal Asian problem, right?
Exactly.
I can make that joke. I don't think you can.
Well, I did.
Because when you make it, it just sounds like you're making fun of a huge continent of people. Largest continent in the world, right? Inarguably.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but most, I think it is. Isn't it true that most Asians live?
Actually, what's interesting is we're about to have a geography major on our podcast. So we can actually ask him when he joins us, what is the biggest continent in the world? I'm sure that's what he went to geography school for.
Well,
I'm kind of fascinated.
I don't know if you know this, but most Asians.
Were you a geography major?
No, I mean, most Asians live in the Dallas area. Little known fact.
Huh?
When it comes to golf, most Asians live in the Dallas area.
I don't understand what you're saying. Is this a joke?
Asian players overperform at this particular course this week. And I think largely it's because most of them live in the Dallas area.
Where are they playing? Oh, most of the Asian golfers. Yeah, yeah. What course are they playing at?
But it was funny, in a text conversation yesterday, I was like, well, most Asians are in the Dallas area, blah, blah, blah. Except Sung JM, he isn't. But they're playing at TPC Craig Ranch.
Can I bet on Siwoo or Tom Kim?
It's literally all Asians at the top of the odds, except for Jordan Spieth. You have Siwoo, I believe, is the market favorite. You have Siwoo, you have Benny On, you have Sungjae, who's coming off a win in Korea and having to deal with some jet lag, but at least he's going west to east, not east to west. Who else? Yeah, I mean, Minwoo Lee, although he's actually Australian.
All right, let's welcome in Kurt Goldsberry to the Bet the Process podcast, and then we'll just talk to you guys all again next week because this was a little bit of a rambling, but I think we're going to have a real NBA better on next week, so that's very exciting. But we're going to welcome in Kurt Goldsberry. We now welcome in the first ever geography major that we've had on the Bet the Process podcast. It's Kirk Goldsberry. Kirk, now I often joke about geography being a major, but we actually had a real question we need to ask you. Asia, biggest continent, correct? Is that right? Biggest continent in the world?
I think that's correct.
That's what Jeff. You studied.
No big deal.
So
I need to correct Jeff.
Is it bigger than Antarctica area wise?
Yeah.
Isn't Antarctica sprawling and huge?
It just gets smaller every day. I mean, not to get political with you, but that place is shrinking, you know.
Oh, if I had asked you this question probably 5 million years ago, what would have been the biggest continent? Well, there weren't continents there, right?
Yeah,
right.
Pangaea maybe might have been the answer. But
because that was the only continent?
Huh?
Because that was the only continent, right?
That's right. But I think the most famous geography major, I'll put it back to you guys, and then Rufus has a note. Who's the most famous geographer in sports? Geography major?
Kirk Goldsberry. That's the answer.
Oh, I would have
said you.
Michael Jeffrey Jordan, the richest geographer in the world. Mike Jordan from the University of North Carolina.
He was a geography major from University of North Carolina, huh?
Yeah.
Do you think that his parents were like, this geography thing is never going to amount to anything, so why are you doing this? We're going to have to support you the rest of your life?
So, I don't know. Probably because that's what my parents would say, so...
I just want to make a correction here, Jeff. We've had one geography major on before. Can you guess who it was?
I have no idea.
Mark DeRosa.
We didn't have Michael Jordan on. It wasn't Michael Jordan, right?
Mark DeRosa, we had a.k.a. Ed Teach.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay. So, Kirk Goldsberry, give me a one-minute soundbite on who you are and why you warrant being on this fine, upstanding podcast that has 7 listeners.
Well, I don't warrant being on this at all, but I'll tell you who I am. I'm a disgraced former professor who somehow turned into a sports analytics guy and a sports writer because I applied my geography and cartography background to visualize the spatial shooting data of NBA players about 12 years ago, Jeff, when I think I met you at the Sloan Conference. And that was like sort of where my geography career started to fade and my basketball career started to rise out of that. And, you know, it's taken me all the way from Harvard College to ESPN to the Spurs front office, USA Basketball as the first analytics guy there, and then back to ESPN and the University of Texas, where I'm a professor and the executive director of our Business and Sports Institute now in Austin, Texas.
How much do you owe to Daryl Morey for figuring out that 3 was greater than 2 and creating an opportunity for really cool visualizations? Because that is what really like highlighted a lot of this, correct?
Well, I think I owe a lot to Daryl simply because he and Jess Gelman stood up the Sloan Conference in the early 2000s, where that gave a platform for people like me to get out new ideas. And I do think, like, in the early 2010s, Jeff, the conversation around data and sports analytics was really in a great period. And there was a lot of lower hanging fruit still on the trees. And so, yeah, Daryl and I had a lot of similar ideas about basketball. He was seeing them, you know, put to use in front offices. And I was sort of arguing in this paper back then, like, we can understand our NBA players a lot better if we start thinking a little bit differently, thinking a little more spatially, thinking a little more visually with these analytics. And we converged on a lot of ideas around the same time. Obviously, Daryl, at a very high level, implemented some of those Sloan fever dreams into actual NBA offenses that changed the sport forever. But I definitely owe him a debt of gratitude, and a lot of people like me do, for just giving us a platform that exists at the MIT Sloan Conference.
So in the world that we're leading right now with computer vision and tracking data and whatnot, like, obviously the visualization stuff is becoming more and more important. If you look at a game like in basketball, obviously that's where you've made your mark. But like, if you look at a game like soccer, is that an area, like, where do you see the opportunities in soccer to use sort of data visualization to better understand the game and even think about new ways to, like, I guess, could you give me an example of something in soccer that you think might be able to, you know, if you had a couple of years to just dive in there and you were handed a bunch of money by a Premier League team to, like, you know, figure some stuff out using data visualization. How would you go about doing that? And like, where would you, do you have any ideas what you'd see?
Yeah, I think in general at 10,000 feet, Jeff, one of the cool things is when data sets get larger and larger and more spatial, visualization becomes more and more important. And visual interfaces to large data sets are one of human beings' best ways to encode and discover information, but also exchange knowledge. So when you look at soccer, like one of the cool metrics that's emerged in soccer over the last 20 years is expected goals, right? But I think if you can use that sort of microeconomics of soccer to understand when a play really breaks, what was the chess move that led to checkmate? Don't just show me the checkmate move, which is most soccer highlights, but show me the move that led to the checkmate, that inflection point. I think surfing large databases and finding those moments is cool and identifying them, but then showing them to players and coaches in the forms of recreated plays with data visualization is an obvious way that we can start to understand those critical chess moves. Like what actually did Zidane do three passes before that raised the XG so much? Like what happened to the shape of the defense? What happened to the offensive positions? So I think that's one way. And another answer I'll give you is, like it or not, the world of spatial data in sports is infiltrating the human body, the athletes' bodies, and how they're moving their arms and their legs. And again, that's something I'm working really hard on right now, is building the shot chart of the human body and understanding how, you know, certain athletes are great because they're able to excel athletically at skill, at movement, and certain types of movements in soccer or basketball or baseball. And I think baseball and golf are ahead in that exact thing, but it's coming to basketball and soccer and football and everything else.
So in this, are you basically talking about like the biomechanics of a swing or a shot, and like how to just generally, you know, use all of that data to figure out what's the perfect way to do it?
Yeah. And I think we're not going to figure that out in the visualization community, but just like an MRI was the analogy I always use. Like if you have to go in and get a surgery, and fortunately, you know, I've had two of them, MRIs are really important to that process, to explaining to a patient, hey, this is what's going on. This is what we're going to do, but they can point to it. X-ray is another sort of more primitive example of that imagery. But in terms of bridging the gap between the data collection and the sort of explanation of the findings to diverse audiences, visualizations and maps have been among the most important documents in human history for that exact purpose. And again, as our data sets get more and more complex and more rich, the role of visualization is just going to become more important, because that's the most efficient way to do this sometimes.
Kirk, first off, I completely agree with what you're saying about visualization sometimes being the best way to communicate. And I think as a whole, analytics, sports analytics kind of has a marketing problem, you know, towards non-analytics people. And I think a big reason for that is we're not communicating it well enough through something like a visualization. Like if you think about a team in the NFL going for two down eight late in the game, all you need is to show a little decision tree that kind of explains it way better than trying to write it out or explain it. And it's why I think it's why announcers have had a lot of trouble explaining these things, or people have had trouble learning from a broadcast, because announcers can't show a visual exactly. But my question
is, why they'd have so much trouble when you're so articulate about explaining it.
Exactly.
So go ahead.
Exactly. So does it get harder to sort of communicate these insights as the data sets get bigger and more rich, and we go to more machine learning based models where it's harder to say X causes Y? It's like these combinations of all these three things together in some unknown way cause Y.
Yeah. And fortunately, like, you know, I was able to come of age, as I said earlier, like the lower hanging fruit era of sports analytics. You know, that's for people in their 20s to figure out, to be honest, at this point. But you're exactly right. I think when I came into the biomechanics space, I didn't have a healthy appreciation for just how complex those data sets were, and how all the coordination patterns between movements. And you need to have multiple kinds of expertise to get there. And indeed, like you say, leaning on machine learning and artificial intelligence is going to surface things that are statistically very important, but can you connect the dots to explain to somebody else why that's statistically important? Can you explain to a Major League Baseball pitcher who might be from the Dominican Republic or Japan or Texas, hey man, this is what we need to do with your elbow so you don't lose your UCL? Can you explain to a goalkeeper, like, this is the right way to attack a penalty kick situation based on what we've just learned about your body biomechanically? That's a very good question. I will say two things. I do believe that that visualization has a seat at the table, but by all means, it's not the only seat at that table. And we need people, especially in the AI and statistical community, to help us know how to build diagnostics and communication tools that that can communicate effectively.
So is someone, so I'm not someone that has to generally communicate knowledge to other people for a career. I mean, I'm building models to bet. And so data visualizations have not really been a huge part of what I do, just because for me, what I'm producing is output. I don't need to be able to explain it necessarily, but what, for someone like me, what could I gain from visualizations? How can I use it to, how can I use them to sort of discover insights that I build into models?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many different ways. And one thing that I would point out, Rufus, is like, it's been woefully underrepresented in higher education. You talk to some of the best people who went to MIT. I don't know if anybody here's went to MIT or whatever, but
nobody of importance.
Very few universities have good coursework in this subject. And that to me is a problem. I've worked hard to help some students to learn it, but you shouldn't be asking this question at this phase of your life. That's sort of one of my professorial points. We need to do a better job in higher education and even elementary schools and high schools to get this in front of kids. Because, you know, the printing press dominated communication for a long time because the printed word was, you know, it was the best way to disseminate information. Well, in the time of the iPhone and Zoom meetings and you know, digital displays everywhere we go, like, we have a better canvas to use than a printed page with black ink on it. But there's been a lag in higher education and training to help people understand how to make maps, when to use a scatter plot versus a line graph. Just those fundamental grammars that are at the heart of what I do haven't been sort of taught to young people in the United States and around the world enough, in my opinion. But the ultimate answer to your question is, like, again, I go back to one of my cliche talking points. Our maps are the most important documents in human history for a reason. Like, when you effectively look at the periodic table, when you effectively sort of condense or encode a large amount of information effectively in a visual, you can change how people think about something. You can store information. Maps were also databases before computers. They store geographic information. But I think we are visual creatures. We are primates with great sets of eyeballs. And if you're not leveraging that sense, you're not doing a good job of encoding your knowledge so that somebody else could decode it. That's what I would say.
That's a good point. And I'm someone that's definitely, like, I'm very geospatially oriented, and I've always been fascinated with maps, and I don't do enough. And I feel like I probably would gain so much more insight if I actually took the time to sort of display information in a way where I can gain insights from it before I guess running code to test things.
Yeah. And I was saying, Jeff will appreciate this example, but when I first got my hands on the NBA shooting data, the first maps I made weren't for anybody but me. I just wanted to see, like, how field goal percentage varied across the playing surface. I had no idea. And some of the most sort of salient memories I have of that time, we're staring at a terminal by myself, looking at really raw plots, being like, holy shit, outside of 4 feet, nobody makes more than 40% of their shots. Like, I always thought the NBA was a 50% league. But those kinds of revelations that you can have for yourself and then sort of pretty up and share with other people, that's really powerful for our generation of communication. Like, that is a real, in the data age, that is a really potent way to exchange information, probably one of the most potent ways.
When I was at Twitter, one of the really strong data scientists there, we were really trying to understand, like, one of the things that was cool about Twitter when I was there is that it was being used in all these ways that people didn't really understand how they were using it. Like people, some people in like countries were using it like Uber, like they were essentially using it to like tweet out their location and that they needed a ride and things like that. But one of the things they did is they created all these visualizations of users based on like just like login patterns and frequency and things like that. And it created these natural clusters, and you could like understand like, okay, what is that cluster doing? They're using this in a certain way. And then you could like actually like hand evaluate some of those accounts and see what was happening. And it was like a way to find networks of people creating spam. And like, it was, you know, like to your point, Rufus, of like, what are things that you could do? Like you could actually create models and look at and visualize them, and you would find, you could use it to find like outlier things that were happening in some of the data that you were looking at that might actually help you understand like, oh, there's like, I bet you could use data visualization to find like match fixing pretty easily. Not easily, but like there would be things that just didn't, like were outliers in a data set that you would say like, huh, interesting. And like, I don't know, anyways.
Yeah, no, I think sort of seeing non-linearities, and I would think our human brain as a processor can pick up on some things that we wouldn't necessarily even, like relationships that we wouldn't necessarily search for. But I think it gets harder and harder as data sets become bigger and bigger. And if you're looking at things where there's very little signal relative to noise, and so you get like, if I display all these plots, like, you know, if the signal and if my R squared on something's like 0.04, well, it's going to be hard to visually see anything. So I think maybe the skill there comes down in, I mean, you're modeling residuals or plotting residuals or doing it in a sort of more intelligent way to be able to sort of only look at for that signal.
Yeah, and I agree. As my advisor used to say, though, like an R squared at 0.04, that's a really important finding. I don't know if you need to share that with a graph or just be like, hey, we tried to look at this and guess what? Save your time. There's nothing there. But sometimes looking at a visual plot of noise and randomness is a finding unto itself, you know.
I mean, look, if you have an R squared of 0.04 and predicting return against the closing line betting Premier League soccer, you're doing pretty well.
There you go.
Okay, so I'm going to move on to something a little bit different, and it's really the state of the NBA right now, which I think is interesting. Have you done any visualizations around what's happening from a foul perspective? Because I think that, you know, there was a lot of kerfuffle about this at right after the All-Star break, that fouling changed. And from my, like, I didn't watch a ton of NBA down the stretch because I'm a Celtics fan and there was really no reason to. But now that I've started watching again, I have, at least to my eye, and I don't know if I've been like inceptioned or if I've been placebo affected, I'm noticing that the game is being called very differently. Mm-hmm. You know, specifically like just the fouling is just, it's, and I'm enjoying it very much so. Like, I'm enjoying the lack of fouls, but Have you looked at that? Have you done any visualizations around that? Is there a visualization to be had around that? So I'll start there.
Yeah. First off, yeah, hell yeah. And there is something happening. The first thing I'd point out is one of the graphs that I've made that I think explains where we were. And I started putting this up in January, February, when a lot of the nerdiest people were like, bro, offensive efficiency in the NBA is surging. And I just a simple line graph showing the rate of points per 100 possessions by season over the last 25 years shows sort of an EKG shape until Adam Silver takes over in 2014. This is his 10th season or so. And then we've seen sort of what Bitcoin people would dream of is a 10-year just like spike, a hockey stick shape. And that hockey stick shape, Jeff, was continuing to rise. And one of the things I need to point out here is that traditionally within an NBA season, I learned this when I was working at the Spurs, offensive efficiency goes up throughout a season. As players get in shape, the offenses get a little more dominant. It's just like one of these nerdy quirks that happens. But that's important.
Do you know why?
Yeah, I'll get into it. But that's important context, because Jeff's exactly right. Something weird happened at the All-Star game. So February, nobody liked the All-Star game. The East beat the West 211, I think, to 184. It was a joke. It's the highest scoring game of all time, even though it was an exhibition. But literally, as we get into second half of February and March, offensive efficiency starts to drop. And that is sort of the signature analytical takeaway of this season. Unlike most seasons where we see that climb through March and April, we saw the opposite. And specifically, one level down in that Russian doll, we started to see the free throw rate and certain types of shooting fouls less and less prevalent. So yes, they're letting them play more would be sort of the common way of saying this. It is good, I agree. But to Rufus's point, this is very unusual in a league where guys sort of get better at offense and get their teams get more cohesive on offense. The coaches have a better sense of who should be out there together. And teams generally exhibit just sharper offensive tendencies throughout this sequence of months on the NBA calendar. So to see such a drastic downturn after the All-Star game, Jeff, was very unusual, and had a lot of the betting markets scratching their heads and some of our friends on Twitter kind of outraged because the models they built for an ecosystem that, you know, isn't supposed to be tampered with in the middle of the season suddenly weren't as good. And so it had all sorts of ramifications in the betting community. But ultimately, as a fan, as an aesthetic person, I like it. They were a lot of offensive players would get some really shitty foul calls, and they've done a better job of cleaning that up.
Which team do you think that this helps the most going forward? If we fundamentally do believe, like, okay, there is a man. I mean, I think we know there's some kind of mandate to call fewer fouls, or I mean, what are the types of fouls? You said that there's certain kinds of shooting fouls. What are the types of fouls that are no longer getting called?
You know, for lack of a better term, the Trae Young fouls, the James Harden fouls, where James would run in, snap his head back, throw his arms up after creating contact with a defensive player. I think those are the exact kinds of off-the-dribble collisions that were caused by offensive players that they've zeroed in on. A couple people have asked me which teams are going to stand to gain the most or least from that change. I wish I had a better answer for you. Of the players remaining in the playoffs, I think Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is actually going to have fewer foul calls against him, but maybe Luka Doncic. But ultimately, I don't think it's going to affect it like that, Jeff. That's my opinion, or at least I'm not smart enough to have a good answer to that question.
I mean, just like maybe it's even a style of play, right? Because like if you watched last night's game against Philly versus the Knicks, you know, obviously Philly pulled it out, but like the Knicks, you know, during that run where they took the lead, like there were a lot of things that plays in there that like there were worlds where someone does that little poke to Embiid and that's called a foul a lot of times. And like they just weren't called. And so I wonder if it does help the Knicks in their style. Although obviously like they lost last night and that.
Well, there was a really pivotal play. I think it was game two in that same series, Jeff, where the Sixers tried to, it was when the Knicks came back from five down with 30 seconds left. And there was a really physical play on an inbounds pass. And I'm sure our friend Daryl remembers this very well. And Tyrese Maxey got fouled at least once, I think twice, according to the last 2 minute report, and it wasn't called. But that did definitely benefit the Knicks because if that's a foul, the Sixers win game two. And now we're in a different world than we're in. So maybe it's the Knicks because they play as hard as anybody and as intense as anybody right now.
What, let's move back just to the season going forward and, you know, with what's happening right now. Like, is there anything that you've looked at with injuries and, you know, are injuries more prevalent? It seems like this playoffs, it's culminating with almost, you know, like you got Giannis, you got Dame, you got Julius Randle, you got on and on and on. Now you got Porzingis. Like, is this anecdotal, like recency bias, or is there really becoming more and more injuries in the NBA?
I don't have a good analytical answer there, but it sure seems like as somebody who's watching these games, you didn't even mention Jimmy Butler. It sure seems like Kawhi Leonard's not 100%, and it seems like every series has somebody affected. Some people in the Players Association side are pointing to their new 65-game rule that is encouraging players to play more But the flip side of that is to encourage them to rest less. So a player like Tyrese Halliburton, who, you know, had $50 million at stake, if he could make all NBA this year, probably should have rested a few more weeks with a hamstring injury. He came back early, was not himself. And, you know, I haven't connected those dots analytically, but other people are trying to. It definitely seems like, look, we play too many games in the NBA, Jeff. We know that. 82 games in the regular season is ridiculous. This is ridiculous.
Agreed. And
it hurts the product because the product is the playoffs, and the playoffs are awesome. And when you're talking about a playoffs without Jimmy Butler, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Julius Randle, Kawhi Leonard, you're talking about an inferior product. But I simply think it's nothing fancy statistically. It's that these dudes are playing 82 games, and that's way too many.
Okay, last thing before we get you out here. Tell us a little bit about the work you're doing. I know there was like the Atlas, and there's like the, you know, you have a best-selling book. Like, tell us a little bit about what it's like to write a book, basically, that is a data visualization book.
Well, I wrote Hoop Atlas, which is 70,000 words and 100 charts. So it is a book with an atlas in the name as a nod to my own cartographic background. But this is a book that looks at what I consider the most interesting sports story of the last 25 years, which is the metamorphosis of the NBA turning inside out, in part because of people like Daryl and Stephen Curry and Michael Jordan. And so I wanted to write a book that sort of reframes the conversation of greatness in pro basketball, Jeff, that doesn't simply count rings and banners, but really looks thoughtfully at how the best players in the world can also sort of bend the league in their direction and influence generations to come. And what we're seeing in 2024 is very different than what we were seeing in 1994, in part because of an analytical awakening, to be sure, but also in part because of Michael Jordan, Allen Iverson, Bruce Bowen, Manu Ginobili, Dirk Nowitzki, guys who challenge conventions, and ultimately Stephen Curry and Nikola Jokic, and changed the league and changed what we thought greatness could look like and should look like in pro basketball and inspired people. So this project really looks at mapping the metamorphosis of the NBA, the modern NBA, and tries to celebrate people, not just because they won championships, because they changed or upended something about pro basketball in the process of becoming a superstar or being a superstar. And graphics, as we've talked about already, are a huge part of that story when you talk about the evolution of the NBA in the last 25 years. But ultimately, Jeff, my thesis as a writer is the integration of words, statistical graphics, and illustrations by my friend Aaron Dana. When that sort of integration is done correctly, you get something greater than the sum of the parts. And it's sort of this multimedia storytelling strategy that I love to use in my writing, because I think there's times where a paragraph is better than a chart. And there's times, obviously, where I think a chart is better than a paragraph. And mixing them and knowing when to use them is really my passion as a basketball writer.
Okay. I have two questions, Jeff, if we have time for them. Okay. The first question is related to that hockey stick trend you talked about in offensive efficiency. Where, at what point is that destined to kind of taper off? Like, what is that sort of theoretical maximum? Because there's the low hanging fruit, the, you know, not shooting the mid range jumpers, right?
Yeah.
Shooting threes and layups. And then there's also offensive efficiency, like fewer turnovers, that, you know, those types of things. But there's got to be sort of a theoretical point where that kind of, where we can't get any higher.
Like, I think we're almost there.
Is free throw percentage going up?
Marginally. So the biggest reason was shot selection was dumb. Shot selection was an inefficient. You know, the jump shooting portfolio of the NBA, even, you know, post Moneyball for about 10 or 15 years, was an inefficient marketplace. The people were just had bad investment strategies on the chessboard. And I think, and if you look at three-point rate, right, Rufus, right now, and effective field goal percentage, you're starting to see some of these giant leaps slow down. Three-point rate has, in fact, plateaued, but we're still getting better and better at shooting the actual shot. So the shot making is still going up, but the hockey stick is starting to flatten out. And indeed, I think sort of some of the critical backlash from the fans about this untapped offense is also the league is messing with its officiating knobs and levers and figuring out how to give the fans what they want. And I think that's a major story. And the other league I'd point to in this regard is Major League Baseball, that in the face of an aesthetic crisis, literally went to the rule book analytically and made some changes that affected their own offensive efficiency or defensive efficiency graph. So I think those are the two things, but I think we're very close to a plateau.
I feel like watching a game that's only three pointers and layups is a little more boring. Do you think, okay. I mean, do you ever see the NBA? This is just a thought. Maybe you widen the court a little bit and make the corner three longer. And then you suddenly, I mean, I think there's a point where you can do things to sort of encourage mid-range shots or not to make mid-range shots versus the best thing, but just to make it so that like, okay, that there isn't this huge, so that the game is played over the entire space, not just these two sort of areas.
Yeah, the bimodal. Yeah, I completely agree. And this is where I got to be careful. I'm speaking subjectively now and about my own preferences. I do think it's time to move the three-point line. The corner three is now 1 in 10 shots. They're worth more than shots in the paint. And the people who make them are not the people who we pay to go see in the gym. They're some of the least interesting players on the court, we'll say, the rooks on the chessboard, to extend that metaphor. But I think, yeah, I mean, every other league from women's college basketball, the WNBA and FIBA, men's college basketball have moved the line back in the last 20 years. The only one that hasn't is the best basketball league in the world, which I think is strange. So I am a big advocate of moving the three-point line. The shot has become too easy for too many, and it has sort of created this bimodal version of the sport, which I don't think is as cool as watching Dirk or Kobe or Michael hit mid-range jumpers in people's faces.
I agree. And my last question is, what advice would you give to somebody, let's say, in the sort of sports analytics journalism-y space or trying to sort of create content in terms of how to sort of up their game in integrating data visualizations of quantitative information into what they're doing?
You know, I go back to, you got to take some classes. You got to learn not just software, but you got to learn visualization, sort of theory, the grammar behind it, the reasoning behind it. A lot of people just want to learn like D3 or whatever sort of scripting libraries help you build the visualization. That's very important, but you also have to understand why and when to use certain tools. And that comes from reading books and coursework. And I think that remains really woefully underrepresented in this kind of conversation. So I always advocate for that. But come on in, the water's warm is the other point I make. This is where it's going. And I thought Jeff's Twitter analogy was great. One of my early hacks was Twitter was 140 characters, but they let me put a picture down there, which is worth 1,000 words, as they used to say. So it is still more bang for your buck on the feed. Like, look at Instagram, look at TikTok, look in the pixel economy. How are you using your pixels? And the answer for most writers and analysts and people in the media is really inefficiently. So I think I would follow you and say people should be doing this, get good at it, because there is a lot of growth there, I think.
Awesome. Kirk, thank you so much for joining us. Those are profound words to end on. And obviously, always great to catch up.
Thank you, Jeff. Good to meet you, Rufus.
Thanks, Kirk. Numbers in a simulated system
that break down the data analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic. The bottom line is watered down. It seems like they don't get it. Puppeteers are but the engines running off unleaded. None of it's organic. It all sounds synthetic. That's why I fucks with Jeff Ma and his dog Rufus. No locks of the year. They just tell you what their truth is. Maybe make your pockets fatter as the bookies get thinner. Give the information, turn and losing betters into winners. Yeah. Sam Hahn, reppin' Rutgers, Jeff Ma, Rufus Peabody, crunching all the numbers, Massey Peabody rankings, we're looking for the edge, analytically driven, crunching all the numbers.